I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. Nolan is considered one of the pioneers of the video game industry, having created the first coin-operated game, as well as Atari's debut game, Pong. Nolan is the author of Finding the Next Steve Jobs. He gave Steve his first job at Atari before Steve started Apple in 1976. Welcome.
It's my pleasure.
Now, while we were doing a sound check before starting the interview, you started to recite the words from The Jabberwocky, a nonsense poem by Lewis Carroll from the novel Through the Looking Glass.
It's a really surprising sound check that people I do on occasion. The Jabberwock with eyes of flame came whiffling through the tonguey wood and burbled as it came. 1-2, 1-2, and through he took his vorpal blade, went snicker snack. He left it dead, and with its head he went clumping back.
Have you memorized a number of poems and excerpts of stories?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we used to do this thing with car trips with a lot of kids. You were always going to give kids 20 or 30 bucks on a vacation. So while we were getting there, I would always make the kids memorize poems, for which they'd get $5. And so by the time you get there, the kids would all know a certain amount of poems. And they've all said that they thought it was stupid at the time, but they really appreciated it ultimately.
Now, when you were growing up, you were one of four.
Correct.
Did your parents also create a game-like environment?
We played a lot of games when I was growing up. It was a ability that we had to constantly sort of mess around and play on an intellectual level. Like, I learned to play chess when I was, like, first grade.
Your mother was a teacher, and your father was in the concrete business.
That's correct.
What exactly did they do?
They primarily did curb and gutter and sidewalks.
Would you ever work with the concrete just in your own time and create things with the concrete?
Oh, yeah.
Like what?
Well, I went through a bomb-making phase where I, in my backyard, I created a blockhouse. If you're going to set off bombs, you don't want to get hurt.
Your father died when you were 15 years old. What role did you play in the company after he died?
I finished up all his contracts and then sold the equipment and closed the business down.
Why was the onus or the opportunity placed on you to do it versus somebody else in your family?
Well, all I had were sisters. It was a Mormon household, and the male is considered to be the big honcho. But I also knew the business, from ordering the concrete to setting up the forms to dealing with the surveyors. It just seemed normal.
Incidentally, you grew up in a Mormon household, and you now have 8 children. Did your religion play a role in your wanting to have as many children as you do?
I had become a agnostic heathen at 18. My actual feeling about having a lot of kids came from my intellectual arrogance. I literally felt that that the world would be better off if I had a lot of my DNA out there. And the intellectual arrogance sometimes, you know, my wife just gets so mad at me when I say that.
When you were a young boy, in addition to having exposure to your father's business, you had entrepreneurial leanings. You had a TV set repair business when you were 10. What was the nature of that?
If you were a geek in the 50s, you were a ham radio operator.
Ham radio, by the way, allowed you to talk to foreigners. Is that correct?
That's correct. Ham radio was an expensive hobby. And so I knew there had to be a way to make more money than the traditional 10-year-old venues. And it really started out by me fixing the family's TV set.
You would go to people's homes to fix their televisions. And there's some folklore that you would buy the parts, let's say, at 10 cents and claim that they were 30 cents to fix.
It was actually more like I'd buy the tubes for about $1.25. and you typically charge $3 to $5 for a tube.
You worked at amusement parks during college, and so you were surrounded by games, whether it was chess in first grade or the amusement parks. And did you have a sense that you wanted to have a career in game creation, or was that more accidental?
I'm not sure that it was accidental, because I had a certain facility for barkerism, if you would. I mean, I did a lot of debate in high school, and if you really look at the pathway, whether it's ham radio, you know, posing as an adult, debate, barkerism, I these were all verbal skills.
Could you show me some of your barkerism?
Oh, absolutely. If you really want a stuffed animal, this is the place to get it. But if you play for 50 cents, that's three times the size animals. And if I was talking to a young man, mm-hmm. I'd say, your girl will love you forever.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. You founded Atari in 1972 with a gentleman, Ted Dabney, whom you bought out quite quickly. But before Atari, you had worked at a company called Ampex, which made tape recorders, among other things. And from there, you started your first gaming company called Sysergy. And again, this was right before Atari.
It's the last S in the dictionary. And as a geek, I thought it was a really cool company name.
You started Sysergy and created your first game called Computer Space, which was modeled after a game called Space War that you had
Correct.
Seen. And this was the first coin-operated game.
Correct.
And you then started Atari in 1972. Your first game was Pong. This, too, was kind of a copy of another game you had seen.
Correct.
Can you describe that?
During the 60s, with the big computers, we all programmed a lot of different games. And, of course, one of them was a ping pong game. When I started Atari, our plan was to be the development house, because we had no factory, we had no money. So we thought, we'll sell our skills for royalties. Game over.
So Atari actually started out as a game design business for other people.
Precisely. And so we had these contracts, and our first employee was a guy named Al Alcorn. You know, we'd been in the business for a couple of years, and somebody says, there's a video game being shown in Northern California, and we've got competition. Mm-hmm. So I had to go up and see it, and it was the Magnavox Odyssey, which was the consumer game. I looked at it, and it was fuzzy and a lot of things, and I said, oh, this is no competition at all. But I looked around and saw that they were playing a game of simulated ping pong. People were kind of having fun with it. And I thought, well, this would be a good learning thing. So I defined the game. I said, do a ping pong game for me.
Mm-hmm. To Al.
To Al. And literally in a week, he had it wired up and was working. And as we say, the rest is history.
Why was it so successful initially?
I think that it was the right game at the right time. First of all, it was simple. You could play the game holding a beer in one hand and playing the game with the other. There was also a funny thing, and I'm not sure exactly how important it was, but the typical woman could beat the typical man playing Pong. And it was because women have better small muscle coordination than men do. Mm. Men have better large muscle coordination, i.e. throwing a ball, that sort of thing. When it comes to just turning the knob, precisely, women were much better. And this was just sort of the dawn of women's liberation and all that sort of stuff. And so it was massively gratifying to women to be able to come up and beat the college football hero.
And you debuted Pong at a local bar, and folklore is that you preloaded the machines with coins to make it seem like the machine was more popular than...
No, we actually did that later. This one was just a test. And there were actually lines out the door so that they could come and play Pong.
So when did you preload the machines to make it seem like the machine was more popular than it was?
Well, later on, as we got into production, people always wanted to test the machines. And so we would give the machine to one of our distributors, who would put it into a random location and see how well it did. And so on Sundays, I'd kind of drive around and figure out where the machine was, find it, and put $50 or $200 worth of quarters in it.
Now, it seems like, though, while the game had wide adoption, that a crucial pivot moment for you was a couple years later in 1975 when some engineers came to you presenting a consumer version of Pong.
Correct.
And this obviously caused it to be pervasive internationally. Was there one distributor or one store, chain of stores, that really helped you get the product out to market?
Absolutely. In fact, we did the consumer Pong. We took it to the toy show, and we set up our booth, and we thought that it was going to be a tsunami of people wanting it. We sold zero. Hmm. And the reason was the toy business at that time sort of had an artificial price ceiling of about $35. And we were trying to get $79 for our unit. And we were somewhat crestfallen.
UNL.
Yeah. And ultimately, we thought, well, maybe we need to sell it through TV shops. Hmm. And they didn't want to touch it because they were in the business of financing things, and they didn't want to finance a game. And finally, we called Sears, and Sears had a sporting goods department that essentially turned into a family room business, selling ping pong tables and pool tables for family rooms. And the previous year, they'd had a consumer pinball machine that they sold out of. Hmm. And they thought, okay, Pong is in bars, pinballs are in bars, this is an appropriate thing for us. And so they climbed onto it, and it was a blowout for us.
It's always interesting to me how you have these accidental allies, how really that one decision maker at Sears could have been that fulcrum for you.
Things sometimes are so binary. Mm-hmm. It's really frightening and surprising that they worked for us.
And in the 80s, you saw Pong in places as far afield as Saudi Arabia, where two close friends of mine were allowed to play for 15 minutes a day, except when their parents were shopping, they'd play longer.
Right.
Where are some of the more exotic places that you've seen Pong machines?
Well, I remember distinctly, I was traveling in Spain to one of these up-the-hill fortress cities, and you drive up and you say, gee, I bet I'm the first American that's ever been here. And then you go into the local bar, and there was a Pong.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, co-founder of the gaming company Atari. We'll hear more from Nolan coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. Nolan is considered one of the pioneers of the video game industry. He was an advisor to Steve Jobs throughout Steve's life. He's the author of Finding the Next Steve Jobs. I want to talk about the culture of Atari that you created. You allowed people such as Steve Jobs to work the night shifts. How come?
I felt that anybody with skill, you should be able to find an adaptation in the workforce to allow that skill to prosper without necessarily it being disruptive to the rest of the environment. And Steve was a little bit difficult. A lot of people really wanted to have him fired because he was direct-spoken and he didn't bathe very often at the time. And I felt, okay, well, I'll just put him on the engineering night shift, which incidentally didn't exist before then. It was partially that, and partially I knew that he and Wozniak hung out a lot, and Wozniak was working at Hewlett-Packard. And so I knew if I put Steve on the night shift, I'd get two Steves for the price of one.
Mm-hmm. You really supported Steve. You paid for his meditation retreats in India. And this is even after he said he was going to stop working at Atari.
Well, that's sort of right and sort of wrong. Mm-hmm. He put in his resignation, and we had a problem in Germany. Nobody wanted to go over and take care of it, but Steve had the skills, and I said, would you go fix the problem in Germany? And he said, yeah, but instead of a return trip, I just want to take that stub of the ticket and go on to India. And I said, fine.
The success of Pong caused you, ironically, not to focus on the computer business. At that time, you had Steve Jobs and Wozniak come to you and say, would you like to buy our little fledgling company, Apple, for $50,000 and own a third of the company? And you said, well, you know what? We're too occupied right now to get involved, and I'd like to stick with the gaming business, because the gaming business was thriving.
Yes.
So it's ironic to me that Pong's success caused you, in a way, to turn down owning a third of Apple. What are your thoughts about that?
It wasn't as much Pong's success as the Atari VCS, the programmable one, which we did in 76. And I think there were two or three issues for me at the time. One, I wasn't convinced that Jobs would be a good CEO. And second, I knew that we had plans to get into the computer business subsequently, but we felt that there needed to be a higher level of integration for a personal computer.
You were right about Steve not being a good CEO, at least initially.
Initially, and I think that one of the unsung heroes of Apple Computer is Mike Markla, who was an extraordinary executive that really brought Apple the gravitas and the adult management that was necessary at the time.
Perhaps it was also Steve's own time in the desert after he was ousted from Apple the first time to really force him to have more maturity and perspective.
You know, there's nothing like a few hard knocks to knock some of the edges off you.
And speaking of a few hard knocks, you had a few dark years yourself after selling Atari to Warner Brothers for $28 million. You butted heads with the Warner Brothers team over how Atari should be run. Ultimately, you left the company. Can you describe what happened?
You know, they were determined to dismantle the corporate culture, because it was a little too freewheeling for them, and they were, you know, we used to call them the suits.
One point of contention was with Atari's integration into the restaurant business with Chuck E. Cheese Pizza. Can you describe that?
Yeah, they said, why would we want to be in the restaurant business? And I said, well, it's vertical integration towards the market. I said, we're selling coin-operated games for $1,500 to $2,000 at the time. I said, over their life, they'll earn $30,000 to $50,000. Didn't take rocket science to say that you're on the wrong side of the transaction. You really want to be in an environment where you're collecting the coin. And that's what Chuck E. Cheese was all about.
And you bought the restaurant chain from Warner Brothers for, was it $500,000?
$500,000.
It went bankrupt in 1984.
Things get into trouble after I leave them somehow. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. But as you know, Atari really did a huge hiccup after I left, because when they had sort of dismantled the creative culture, they didn't bring any new games out. And so the fabled 1982-83 implosion of the video game business, totally predictable. In fact, I made more money shorting in Warner stock because I could see it coming than I actually did on the sale. But that's another story.
And similarly, when you left Chuck E. Cheese also, the company suffered.
Yeah, Chuck E. Cheese was never about being in the restaurant business. It was all about a ecosystem around a big game center. Once I solve all the problems, I like to get professional managers in to fix things. And sometimes that doesn't work. And we got a professional guy in that knew the restaurant business, and he wanted to turn it into a restaurant, and with really disastrous results.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. I want to talk about Catalyst Technologies, which is the company that you created, or the business incubator, really, that you created after leaving Warner Brothers. And it's striking to me how clairvoyant you've been in predicting technologies even before their time. Some of the companies that you created at Catalyst was a company called Cadabrascope, which was a computer-assisted animation company. Tell me which company it ultimately became.
It ultimately became Pixar.
It seems like a little-known fact to me that you had the germ for Pixar.
It was one of those things where it can be very, very costly to be too far ahead of your time. The technology and the computers, the cost of computer MIPS at that time was incorrect. It really needed to come down in cost by almost an order of magnitude to make it a viable business. I didn't know that when we started it, because I said, gee, you know, we can do all this manipulation of graphics. And though we did some really cool stuff, yet it was still cheaper to do it by hand.
And so ultimately you sold it to Lucas,
right.
And then the company, you know, became Pixar. Part of the reason you had to sell it was you were in financial distress after the Chuck E. Cheese incident. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically I borrowed a lot of money and hypothecated my Chuck E. Cheese stock. And so when Chuck E. Cheese kind of went down, all of a sudden my security covenants went away. And it took me a little while to lick my wounds on that puppy. But more than that, I spent too much money chasing the personal robotics business.
With your company, Androbot.
Androbot. And that was another one where the technology, though close, was not quite good enough.
What were the robots supposed to do, by the way?
Oh, they're supposed to bring you a beer.
They collected static electricity along the way. And
yeah, when you have a computer and you get a blue screen of death, nobody gets hurt. You just reboot and carry on. In the robotics business, all of your collision avoidance, all of your safety mechanisms become inoperative. And if you have a 50-pound robot hurtling across the room and the computer crashes, all of a sudden, nobody knows what the outcome's going to be. And we used to have nightmares about a robot running towards a stairwell while somebody was coming up, and all of a sudden you have this 50-pound block of stuff coming down on your head.
I've read that your wife doesn't really like to talk about these years with such failures. And you've mentioned that Nancy put you on a robot 12-step program because you do. That is a love of yours.
It really is. And I can't imagine the future without a personal robot.
Another technology that perhaps was before its time, you invented in 1985 ETAC.
Correct.
And that was an auto.
1983.
In 1983, an auto navigation system that became the backbone for what companies?
Google, or, you know.
Google Maps.
Google Maps, Garmin, any of those. It turns out that the company was successful. I mean, it had a good exit on it.
To Rupert Murdoch.
To Rupert Murdoch, yeah. But it was one of those things where it was very obvious to me that automobile navigation electronic was just around the corner.
How much of your headspace is occupied by these technologies that, if only they were fast-forwarded 20 years, they would work? How much of your psychology do these failures take up versus, you know, the pioneering successes that you've had in your quiet moments?
In my quiet moments, I believe that you never know when the timing is going to be exactly right. And I think as I've gotten older, I'm more patient. For example, my current project is Brain Rush, which is all about changing the dynamics of how people learn using some of the best brain science. I personally believe that it is exactly the right time, exactly the right place.
In addition to the timing being right, the product or the innovation might just have to be tweaked and reinvented a number of times before it works. In your book, you talk about companies like WD-40, you know, having several failures before they finally came up with a product that worked. What does WD-40 stand for?
You know, the 40th iteration of a formula that really cuts grease.
It was also striking to me the number of innovations that have been underappreciated at first due to a failure of imagination, yet turn out to be significantly impactful. You talk about in your book, for instance, the Xerox copy machine. What was said about the Xerox copy machine?
Oh, they said that, you know, why would you need these? You know, carbon paper works really well. And the world's potential market for copy machines is 5,000 at most. The founders of Xerox explained why their photocopier market was not large enough to justify production. You know, it just goes on and on.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Nolan Bushnell, founder of the gaming company Atari and Chuck E. Cheese restaurant chain. In the literature I've read about you, I was expecting much more arrogance. Have you changed at all your disposition throughout your life, your career?
I think a little bit. Early on, I had some tremendous successes at a very young age.
You were 29 when you started a talk.
Correct. And I think that that always gives you a little bit of an elevated sense of self. I was more arrogant in my 20s and 30s than I am now.
What is the cause of the toning down of that arrogance, you know, perhaps in your personal life, for example, with your wife?
Oh, I think my wife thought that I was a jerk.
How did you meet her?
I met her. She was working. She was in pre-law at the university, but her dad owned a restaurant, and she would bartend and waitress over the weekends. And that was right around the corner from the Atari factory. And I just thought she was spectacular, spunky and really smart. And I decided that she was worth pursuing. And so slowly I found out what she thought was objectionable about me, and I modified, at least around her.
What are some examples of the things that offended her?
Oh, I think I would often come in and hold court with a bunch of the Atari employees. It was more of a lord of the manor kind of relationship than a bunch of band of brothers. And she didn't like that. And I think she didn't like, there were a lot of women that were sort of clustering around me. I mean, I was young, and some people thought I was good looking and rich, and that tends to attract a lot of riffraff. And my wife just didn't want to have to deal with that.
So you claimed to her that you would change?
Oh, no, I didn't tell her I was going to change. I changed. I was a good poser. I think I'm a great husband. I can honestly say that we've been married 36 years now, and I would do it all over again. And yeah, I think that she thinks the same way.
To what extent, aside from your wife, did the challenging years professionally, to what extent did that also cause you to just have a little bit more realistic sense of self?
Oh, there is nothing like a major face plant that to say, hey, you're not as cool as you thought you were.
You were a mentor to Steve Jobs throughout his life. And what's striking to me in understanding your life is how many parallels you had with Steve Jobs and with Apple. One is the computers for the masses at Apple versus, you know, gaming for the masses at Atari, or Steve's poaching people from Hewlett-Packard or from Atari.
Oh, poached a lot from us.
And you poached a lot from Ampex, the company that you had worked prior. Or Nolan Bushnell, your right-hand man was Al Eichhorn, and Steve's right-hand man was Wozniak. And both of your partners were really the engineering minds, and you two were the marketing minds. So you guys seem to pong off each other.
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, I consider myself to be a great engineer, too, though. I think that there are certain kinds of entrepreneurs that see wonderful technology, whether it be the mouse at Xerox PARC with Steve, or seeing the opportunities for video games from the big computer labs. You know, this whole idea of that translation from the very, very esoteric, the very expensive, the very cutting edge, into figuring out a way to make it available. And a lot of times it takes a little bit of a cheat.
You had an influence on Steve's life, starting with you and Al Eichhorn employing him at Atari. How was he influential in your life, just on a personal level?
Well, I think Steve, to me, was always a beacon of enthusiasm. And more than that, we used to have these wonderful, wide-ranging conversations about philosophy. I mean, I was always from the school of Hegel and Kant and the Western philosophers, and Steve was more about Confucius and Buddhism and the Eastern philosophers. And I think that the proper synthesis of a life plan is to really have a synthesis between the Eastern philosophical positions in the Western.
And speaking of this fusion, right before we started the interview, you actually did a lotus pose for me, a lotus pose handstand for me, right before we recorded.
Yeah, it's embarrassing. The path to nirvana is, I think, to be as broad in your curiosity and your database as you possibly can. And it really has to do with brain science. For example, a lot of people think, gee, I do the New York Times crossword puzzle every day, therefore my brain is really getting smart. No. It turns out that all the neurogenesis of doing the New York Times crossword puzzle happened probably the first 6 months that you were doing it. And after that, nobody home. I like to play chess. I like to play Go. I'd be willing to bet that 90% of the neurogenesis for me playing chess happened between the ages of second and third grade. And even though I've been playing the rest of my life, nothing there. You've got to do different things.
And you certainly have so many hobbies, from chess to sailing to debate to what else is there?
Well, on my list, I am going to start doing some long-distance bicycling. I just got back from Machu Picchu. I plan to do probably another six companies.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
My guest has been Nolan Bushnell. Coming up, we'll hear from Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, an institution that's dedicated to developing Africa's next generation of leaders. The school admits students from across Africa and is committed to encouraging graduates to stay in Africa. Fred founded African Leadership Academy in 2004 when he was 27 years old. He's a graduate of McAllister College in Minnesota and has an MBA from Stanford Business School. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You lived in over four countries before you were 18 years old. Why did your family keep moving?
You see, Ghana had an excess supply of skilled labor. And so other countries in Africa, as they were developing, would come to Ghana to look for professionals like lawyers and teachers and doctors. And my dad was a magistrate and my mother was a teacher. So they were recruited by different countries in Africa to come and work in their civil service. So that's how we moved around.
You did your primary and secondary schooling in Africa, and then you went to McAllister College in Minnesota. What was the thinking behind that?
My mother had been to graduate school in Minnesota. And so when I was growing up, I used to look at pictures in her album, and I would see pictures of her, you know, in the snow. McAllister is also known in Ghana and Africa because that's where Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations, went to college.
Did you have the intention of definitely returning, or was there part of you that thought, oh, you know what, maybe I'll stay put in the United States?
No, you see, one thing that all these experiences of living and working in different parts of Africa did is it made me very passionate about being an African. Mm-hmm. So most people who grew up in Africa only know the country that they were born in. In fact, their perceptions of the rest of the continent is what they see on CNN. I had seen that there was tremendous beauty in Africa and tremendous potential, that we were really the next frontier of development.
What did you think were the key ingredients to helping with Africa's development?
When I look at the history of Africa, we've been through different phases of development. You had the period in the 60s, which was the independence era. You know, African countries breaking away from the shackles of colonialism and gaining their political independence. And then you moved into phase two, which was the period of real political instability. Then phase three, which is more stability, and there's more semblance of democracy. And when, you know, a change of government happens by force, it's seen as an exception now, rather than the rule it was 20 years ago. The thing that's left to be done in Africa now, I believe, and this was my perception when I was graduating from McAllister College, was to create prosperity and then to eradicate poverty. So the first job I got out of college was with McKinsey, mm-hmm. the consulting firm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to understand business. I wanted to see how business was being done in Africa. And that was how I began my journey of understanding, you know, what we needed to do to bring this next phase of change to Africa.
There have only been like a handful of leaders that have helped to transform African society, ranging from, you know, Nelson Mandela to Desmond Tutu. Why do you think Africa has kind of such a scarcity of leadership?
You see, when Ghana got independence in 1957, there was something like 18,000 university graduates of the whole of sub-Saharan Africa, if you exclude South Africa from the picture. Countries like the DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, had 4 university graduates in 1957. So imagine the independence era arriving in Africa in the late 50s and early 60s. When Kenneth Kaunda was forming his cabinet in Zambia, you know, he had 4 university graduates to work with. And so that's the state at which Africans found themselves in the first set of leaders who took over the continent.
Your mother started a school in Botswana, and you, at age 18, became the headmaster of that school. Why did you become the headmaster of the school?
My mother had, was a really great teacher, and so the parents approached her and said, you know, would she set up a school for them? But she had no experience raising money. My dad had just passed away. He died of high blood pressure and hypertension, basically had a heart attack, yeah. So she didn't have any financial resource of her own, and she had to look after 4 kids. So she said, look, I can't quit my job as a teacher and start the school for you. What I will do is I'll start a study group. And then it grew, more and more kids came, and then the next thing was 20 kids and then 25 kids. And then I had finished high school, and I had a year to wait before I went to college. And so my mother said, you know, why don't you run the school for me? And so for a year, I was the headmaster. I taught some classes. I managed some of the teachers and dealt with the parents. And in the afternoons, I'd go and meet with her and we'd discuss the strategy for the next day. And today, that school is one of the top performing primary schools in Botswana.
And it's called Mount Pleasant English Medium School.
Exactly. And it has about 300 children.
Did you think, you know, during that year that, you know what, I'd like to make a career out of being the headmaster of a school?
Absolutely not. I had no idea that one day I'd be back in education and in leadership development. You know, I saw my future as a businessman.
So here you were. You were at McKinsey, and then you decided to go to Stanford Business School. And McKinsey paid for your education at Stanford Business School, about $125,000. And you were supposed to return to McKinsey, but instead you decided to start African Leadership Academy. What was the catalyst for saying, you know what, there is a scarcity of leaders in Africa, I'm going to start ALA, rather than return to McKinsey?
So in between my first and second year at Stanford, as most MBA students do, I had to find an internship. Given that I was supposed to go back to McKinsey after my MBA was finished, I thought, let me just do something interesting. So there was an opportunity to go and work in Nigeria to help set up a microfinance institution. Mm-hmm. And I went to Nigeria, and in the course of that, I met these wealthy families who were complaining to me about the fees they were paying to send their, you know, children to expensive boarding schools in the UK. They were paying about $50,000 a year to send them there. So I was thinking, wow, why are we paying so much money to send young people to these schools in the UK? Why don't we have the best education institutions in Africa that can keep them on the continent? Because I was worried that these young people that were leaving were the future leaders of Africa. So that's when the light bulb went off and I said, you know, why don't I actually build this institution? And so I said, you know what, I need to find a way to pay this $120,000 off to McKinsey and really do this. I didn't know where I was going to get the $120,000 from, but when I graduated, I called McKinsey and said, you know, I'm not coming back.
How did you raise the $120,000 to pay them back?
I had borrowed some money from my mom. And then also I had raised some money to start ALA from my friends and family, and part of that was the salary I was going to pay myself. And so what I did is I took the salary that I was going to pay myself and gave it to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
So then I had no salary to live on for the next 2 years.
And where were you living at the time?
In Johannesburg.
So what was it like having no salary? What did that mean daily?
It meant daily. I didn't know where my meals were going to come from, where I would get money to buy clothes from, and, you know, other basic things that people who have a salary take for granted. So I had to become creative in terms of the way I lived. My friends would buy me lunch. So I made sure that I always had a lunch appointment with a friend.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Where did you live?
I slept on people's couches and, you know, friends' cottages in the backyards mm-hmm. and those kinds of things.
Your mother, as we discussed, was an educator. What was her perspective?
She thought I was crazy, even though she had done it herself. She hadn't done it, I guess, in such a risky manner.
Her name's Edna, and she eventually gave you $100,000, which, by the way, have you given back to her, or was it more of a gift?
Well, it's something I was meant to pay back, but I think over time she's forgiven the loan.
Ah, it's a forgivable loan.
Exactly.
I see. So here you are sleeping on friends' couches and having people buy you lunch. Was there one or two people in the early days that really helped to, you know, get the Academy off the ground or to make the idea of the Academy more of a reality?
Yes, definitely. I mean, they were my partners, my co-founders. One was a man called Chris Bradford, who I had met when I was at business school, and then my two former bosses from McKinsey. Mm-hmm. We initially raised about $200,000.
And then you were looking to raise $7 million, and the bulk of that came from a woman named Rebecca Capizio. Why was Rebecca interested in African Leadership Academy?
We set out on a search for a possible campus. And we went to this area just outside of Johannesburg called the Cradle of Humankind, which is where some of the oldest human remains have been found. It's a very beautiful setting. And there was a conference center there that we approached and said, you know, can we rent this conference center and use it for our academy? And they said, you know, sorry, we're fully utilized, but why don't you go next door? There's a property there. There was a manager at the farmhouse, and we kind of shared what we were trying to do. And he said, you know, we don't have a space there that's big enough for you to use for your campus, but the owner of this property is very interested in education. Hmm. So why don't you send us something and we'll send it to the manager, to the owner. And we didn't know that the owner was this woman, Rebecca Capizio, who comes from the Oppenheimer family that owns De Beers in South Africa.
De Beers, the Diamond Empire.
The Diamond Empire, exactly. So we sent her a one-page description of what we were trying to do, and she wrote back and said, you know what, I don't have a facility that you can use, but I like this idea so much that I'm willing to build it for you.
Huh.
And we thought, wow, does she really know who we are? I mean, just from a paragraph, she's willing to commit. You know, does she know how much money we would need? So then we said, you know, okay, we're coming to Seattle in a few weeks. Can we come and meet with you?
Because she was living in Seattle at the time.
Exactly. That's why she wasn't at her property when we visited. Mm-hmm. And so we went and met with her, and we said, look, this is going to cost us about $5 million to build it. Are you willing to commit this money? And she said, yeah. And that changed everything.
Do you remember that specific moment? Were you in her house when she talked to you about it?
We're sitting in a lobby in a hotel in Seattle. And she had come with her husband, and I was there with Chris. When we met her, it was kind of a surreal experience. You know, we were these 27-year-old guys with just an idea on a piece of paper.
Incidentally, in addition to Rebecca Capizio, another woman was pretty instrumental to you in the early days, and that was the former CEO of Hewlett-Packard, Carly Fiorina, mm-hmm. who had gone to high school randomly in Ghana. Mm-hmm. How did she help you?
At this time, I didn't know how to raise money. I had been to visit the dean at the Stanford Business School to ask him for advice on how to raise money. And one of his pieces of advice to me was that you should never ask for money in your first meeting with someone. So this is our first meeting with Carly Fiorina. And, you know, we had lunch with her, and then at the end she said, okay, so why did you want to meet with me today?
Mm. And meanwhile, you have his advice in your ear.
I had his advice in my ear. I said, don't ask her for money. So I said, well, you know, perhaps you could help us with your relationships in the technology world to help us get some computers for our school. And he said, okay, fine, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, and I said, well, you know, maybe you could also help us build relationships with the South African government. And she said, yeah, sure, I'm happy to do that. And then she said, is there anything else? And so at this point, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, she's asking us if we need money. But the dean of Stanford said, don't ask for money on your first meeting. So Chris is kicking me under the table saying, you know. So then eventually I was like, well, we're also looking to raise money, and, you know, perhaps you could contribute. 3 months later, she gave us $100,000.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy, a school focused on training Africa's future leaders. How did you encourage applicants? How did you encourage people to come?
We had, you know, surveyed parents. We had talked to headmasters of other schools in Africa, had asked them about the concept that we were proposing. And, you know, the feedback was generally quite positive. But we had never actually spoken to young people. And if you think about it, they were the client base, the customers, in a way. So 2007, we said, oh, actually, no, we're opening our doors a year from now. We need to start recruiting our first class. So we hired a team of people, and we went around and started visiting schools. And we did a mailing to about 2,000 schools. And we were shocked when the deadline arrived and we had received 1,700 applications from 35 countries for our first class. And there were only 100 places available.
Who were some students who really impressed you? You're like, wow, I want this student in my school.
One of the things we asked in the application form, we said, tell us about a time you identified a need in your community, mm-hmm. and what did you do about it? And so Belinda's application, she talked about how she was she lived in a suburb of Harare in Zimbabwe. And every day she used to see these three kids coming around and begging for food. And so she approached them and to find out why they were begging, and it turned out that their parents had died from AIDS. And so she decided that she wanted to do something about this to help them so they could stop begging. And she had been learning agriculture at school and was learning how to raise chickens. So she asked her mom for, you know, like about a couple of dollars and used that to buy a couple of chickens that could lay eggs. And she built this chicken business. And with that, she was able to generate enough income that she was able to feed this family of three, these three kids. And then she taught the kids how to look after the chickens and also how to grow a vegetable farm and so on. And soon they were able to look after themselves completely independently, and they were able to have enough funding that the oldest child could now go to school. And she did all this by herself when she was 16, 17.
You created from the start a financial incentive for your graduates to stay put in Africa. How does that work?
The vast majority of the young people that we admit to the academy cannot afford to pay the fees. So we give them scholarships. It costs about $25,000 per child for 1 year. We don't give them that scholarship as a grant, but as a forgivable loan. And so when they graduate from the two-year program and go into college, that loan continues accruing interest. So all we ask is that they return to Africa by the age of 25 and stay and serve the continent for 10 years. They can do whatever they want to do in Africa. And if they don't return, or if they leave at some point before they're 10 years old, then they have to repay that loan with interest. Mm-hmm. There's a model like this in Singapore and in Thailand. There's a school called Raffles Junior College, and they have a 97% return rate.
African Leadership Academy aims to develop the next generation of leaders. What does that mean practically or daily?
A big part of this development is what we call giving them practice in leadership. So while they're at the academy, they all have to do what's called a culminating project, where they either have to launch a business or launch a social venture in the community. And what we're trying to do there is to simulate the kind of experience that Mark Zuckerberg had in his dorm room at Harvard when he started Facebook. So over the last few years, we've launched about 42 different ventures, ranging from a bank that operates on our campus to a farm on the campus to a clothing store to sustainable community agricultural projects that have all been spearheaded by these young people. And we have a venture fund on our campus that invests in them. And our aim there is to really give them the taste of being an entrepreneur and being a leader in real time and real life. And we believe that if you give them this defining experience at that age, it gives them the foundation and the passion to go on and do entrepreneurial ventures and to be leaders on a much bigger scale later on in their lives. If I hadn't had this experience when I was 18, running my mother's school, I don't think I would have had the confidence or the experience to one day do what I'm doing today with ALA, which is on a much bigger scale. And if you look back, a lot of entrepreneurs, Richard Branson, when he was 15, 16, was selling magazines. And that prepared him to go and launch Virgin one day. And so it's the same kind of practice and leadership that we like, that we spend a lot of time trying to give these young leaders. And then the other thing we're doing is exposing them to a network of mentors and potential advisors and people who can open doors for them as they go through different stages of their lives.
So what's an example?
There's a young man from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's a refugee. He came to ALA on a scholarship, and while he was there, we had a guest speaker who visited campus, And this woman is involved in using theater as a way to help victims of trauma. Joseph was so struck by her talk that he said, you know, I really want to go and replicate this in my refugee camp. And in the process, the woman also got so involved that she helped him raise $20,000, and he used that to build the first high school in his refugee camp. And that's all happened because of that network that was struck, that conversation that happened when this woman visited campus to be a speaker.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Fred Swanaker, founder of African Leadership Academy.
If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.